Podcast where we celebrate Black femme genius with a squee! Somebody's happy to be back from hiatus. I am Dee Dee. I go by Dust Daughter on Twitter.
And I'm Enda. I go by Enda's Corner on Twitter.
And we're back, the triumphant return again. We're available on Twitter at Black Girl Squee, all one word. Same on Tumblr. You can find the show on Apple Podcasts and Google Play and anywhere else that you want to listen to your podcasts by searching for Black Girl Squee. Our podcast home is at Simplecast, so you can find all of our episodes at blackgirlsquee.simplecast.fm. And you can email us at blackgirlsquee@gmail.com. So just a reminder, one of our policies is that we spoil shit. That's our spoiler policy. And we're not sorry about it. We also squee real loud, some louder than others, as you can see. And we cuss a lot. And sometimes talk about dick. Not today, but most days.
I don't know. We might get to a little today.
Might be a little dick.
Maybe a little.
Again, not sorry. We grown ass women. And
yes.
So now that we've got all the warning stuff out of the way, let's get into some news.
All right. Well, this our first item. This woman you may not have heard of if you've, you know, been in a cave somewhere for the past 20 years, but our very own Missy Elliott has been inducted into the Songwriters Hall of Fame. She is the first female rapper to be inducted, and she's only the second rapper to be inducted after Jay-Z. So right. She's being nominated not just, you know, for stuff she's written. She's also written for everybody else, including Aaliyah, Ciara, Maya, Tweet, hell, everybody. So, yes.
Toby.
Yeah.
Just about every group in the 90s.
702. I remember that. Yep. Oh, girl,
Monica.
Yes.
Monica. Remember, knock, knock, knock. Stop knocking.
Yeah, I think Missy was actually writing songs, writing and producing before she was even performing on her own. That's how a lot of them started out. So, I mean, it's about time Missy has gotten some recognition for her contributions and for everybody who thought for some reason she was like, didn't know who she was before she was at the Super Bowl with that girl. Seriously. Y'all are 12. Y'all are 12.
Oh, gosh. Well, I mean, yeah.
I know, right?
Some people are young. I mean, I just...
Exactly, yeah.
I'm not one of them, so...
yeah, okay. Yeah. But really so, happy for her, you know. To Missy being inducted in the Songwriters Hall of Fame, we give a big...
And speaking of Hall of Fame, Miss Janet Demita Jo Jackson has been inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame.
Yes,
we may have talked about that before, mm-hmm. But it bears repeating because it's about time. She should have been in the first time she was nominated, but second time around is good too. So welcome to the Hall of Fame, Miss yep. Jackson. We give you all of the
Okay. All right. So another of our favorites here, you may know of this incredibly gorgeous woman named Gina Torres. Well, there's finally a name for the spinoff show that we've been promised for like the past 2 years. It will simply be called Pearson. They just found this out this past week. And they said there was a backdoor pilot to the show, but I missed it in suits, or maybe I didn't miss it and just don't remember it because it's been a very long time since I saw Suits, and I don't care anymore because she's not there anymore, and neither is Megan. But anyway,
just tell me the daytime and what.
I don't know. They said when Suits returns, but they still have. I still don't see a date for this show. Give me this show already, so I can look at Gina Torres looking like she does in that wardrobe.
Yes, they're giving me all these other details that I don't really care about until. Well, it says, they haven't given a premiere date. And
Because I don't know any of these other people that's going to be in the show, so I don't really care.
I don't. They're not Gina. And
exactly. And they're not Gina Torres' wardrobe. So, to Gina Torres and hopefully this soon coming show, please, we give a big
Call me, Gina. Call me.
She's divorced, so.
That's right. She free. sorry, Lawrence, but.
I like you, but no. This
call me.
She just made a lot of people happy.
Yes. Marsai Martin is set to be the youngest executive producer in Hollywood history. Martin, who plays one of the daughters on Black-ish, pitched the idea for her new movie Little to Black-ish EP Kenya Burris when she was 10. And now Little is a feature film starring Marsai Martin alongside Regina Hall and Issa Rae. So the movie was written by Tracy Oliver, who wrote Girls Trip, and directed by Tina Gordon.
Oh, look at all the women on this.
Yep. So I think
she's 14.
Now, bless her heart. To Marsai Martin, we give a big...
Yeah, I love that little girl so much, but it's like when I was that age, what was I doing with my life? But never mind. Okay, and a bit heavier news, but still some good news. This month, a couple of weeks ago, we found out that Centoya Brown has officially been granted clemency. If you remember her story, she was 16 when she was a victim of sex trafficking. She killed a man she felt like her life was in danger. So it was self-defense. And like after 15 years, she's finally going to be granted clemency because they were at first saying that she had a life sentence and was going to have to serve at least 51 years before she could get out. But the governor finally responded, and all the activists who for years have been working with her on her case and finally got, you know, the attention it needed. Her story got out, and even though she will be paroled for another 10 years, I think, after she's released in August of this year, I'm still trying to take that, you know, at least she's not going to be in jail. And so, yeah, I think they're setting up like a GoFundMe and stuff for, you know, so she'll have something, you know, waiting for when she gets out so she can put her life back together. But, man, to be 16 and then have this horrible thing happen to you, and then you still have, what, 25 years of your life to the state because you protected yourself. That's fucked up. But like I said, she's getting out. And I'm trying to just look at that positive right now.
Looks like she will have to go to counseling, but I mean, she should be going to counseling now. We'll have to do community service, try to get a job. Hopefully, she'll be able to find work somewhere. So it's not, it's an if.
Exactly.
It's not like other people who kind of get everything cleared from their record. At least she will be out. It's fucked up that she won't be cleared and that this will always be on her record. And it shouldn't be, since she was defending herself. She was a child being solicited by someone older. To all the people who have been working to get her freed, and to Centoya Brown, we give a because you know most of the people that were trying to get her out were black, were other black women.
Exactly.
Anybody checking for us but us. So
exactly.
With that, we just wanted to get a few little news tidbits that we could not ignore. Since we have come back from hiatus. And now we will get into our main topic, which is our interview with our guest. And our guest is Maria. And you've heard her on the Nerdgasm Noir Network podcast. And you read her movie reviews on Shakefire. She also has another podcast called the B-Roll Podcast, where she reviews movies with a couple of other co-hosts. And you've also heard her, if you listen to the Black Girl Squee Network, you've heard her on a little show we used to do called Missives from the Underground. So she's getting around on these podcast streets. And welcome to Black Girl Squee, Maria!
Hi, Maria!
That's my applause.
I'm refraining from I'm refraining from the unexpected squee. So I know people don't like when I do that.
So welcome to
the show.
Thank
you so much for having me.
And
thank you for coming.
Yay! So glad you could be here. So how did you first start doing movie reviews?
Well, I've been writing online reviews since about 2001. I was writing news articles for UrbanMix.com, AtlantaUrbanMix.com, and then like anime reviews for PopCultureShock.com. Oh. And in between time, I would go to screenings, and it was this website, Shakefire, where you could win passes to go to screenings. So I would go, and I met, you know, a bunch of people there, and they had forums, so I was active on the forums. And I applied to write there, but didn't hear anything, which is not unusual. But then, like, Twilight came out, and then Hunger Games came out, and I was updating the forums with all these news and information and things like that, and they asked me to create a weekly blog for them with that kind of news and information. So I was able to do that and interview some of the actors from the films and write reviews of those movies, of course, and it just kind of segued into writing regular movie reviews.
Great. So this was way before you joined Nerdgasm.
Yes, I didn't start podcasting with Nerdgasm until about 2012.
And how did that come about? How did you start?
Well, I was listening to their podcast. I was just a fan at first. And then I got on Twitter and then I befriended everybody somehow. And then I asked if I could be a part of it. And they were like, yeah. So that's how I remember it. Anyway, it's not that good detailed story. But
that's still cool. Because they're like the OGs of this black girl nerdy
it's
shit.
It's true.
Other people think it's somebody else, but
nobody else.
So nobody else. It's Nergesen Mar. So exactly. Good save. So do you think you critique movies differently now than when you first started?
Yeah, I think so. You know, seeing so many films and everything, at first you're just kind of happy to be there. So you try to be very positive about everything. But I feel more safe in being more critical about things that I see, especially when it's supposed to be things for black people or black women that you're just supposed to like. And sometimes they're not always great. Sometimes they could be better. You know? Or even things that are supposed to be critically acclaimed and up for all these awards or whatever, and it's not really hidden. You like it because it's about Hollywood. So it's a lot easier to be more critical. And then also know what I like more, and it's easier to know what to expect most of the time. I would say so. Most of the time when I'm sitting with my fellow, you know, press or critics, I'll often be the only black woman there. And it didn't really strike me too much until I was going to the screenings, and the people who, you know, prepare the screening, they're always there. And they were like, oh yeah, I know you. I'm like, wait, you do? And I'm the only, yeah. So there are things they miss. Particularly even when it comes to Beale Street, this one white critic that I know, I asked him how he liked the film, and he was saying that he enjoyed it, but he felt that it was disjointed.
Oh God.
Yeah. And I was like,
You don't.
Okay.
You've never seen a film that has, non-linear structure. If you've seen Pulp Fiction, you can get that.
Exactly. That's exactly what I was thinking. I'm like, I bet this guy loves Quentin Tarantino, though.
Yeah.
I bet he does.
Probably.
Didn't you say that somebody also didn't get that scene, the car scene in Widows?
Oh! That was, my favorite scene in the entire film.
Did you encounter other critics where that scene went over their head, Maria?
No, I have. You know, I haven't really talked to any critics about
that. That's smart. Saves a headache.
I'm sorry, but Steve should just win all the awards for that scene alone.
It's everything.
Yeah. It's so smart. It's just good. Oh God, I love that.
Yes.
But What do you think a lot of critics ignore about films?
I think they have a hard time connecting to things that aren't within their own experience.
Ooh, that's a word.
Period. Right.
Yeah.
You know, because there was also this movie, Suburbia.
Was that last year?
Suburbia. Uh-huh. Suburbicon. What? Yeah. And to be fair, the trailer is extremely misleading. Mm-hmm. The trailer is telling you it's one kind of movie and it is absolutely not that kind of movie at all. But they have this whole storyline that is not in the trailer that follows kind of the same journey of the first family that moved into this Levittown up in New Jersey. It was the first suburban community. And of course it was all white at the time. And then this family moved in, they're all black. And kind of how they're harassed by the community And while they're being harassed by the community for simply wanting to live, their neighbor is out here killing his family and nobody notices.
Jesus.
Because he's white. Right. Hmm. And another same guy, actually, I asked about the movie and he was like, what was that about? I don't understand. I don't get it. Like, is this disjointed thing? Right. I'm like, okay.
like we clearly can't have a conversation. How? Oh gosh.
I explained the movie to him and like what they were trying to do and how they're trying to draw these parallels. But I knew, I was like, this is going to throw a lot of people off.
Yeah.
But yeah.
It's like going into most newsrooms and seeing them being predominantly white, and you just know that a lot of news and a lot of coverage is just slipping through the cracks because nobody thinks of that.
It's not going to get the perspective it deserves if you have no one there who can see it.
Right. So, I mean, you watch so many films. What do you look for in a film, though?
What I look for in a film, there's always something that a film is trying to achieve. And I look to see if it's achieved that thing. Even if the film is bad, did it do what it was trying to do? Did it try and send the message it was trying to send? Did it try and make the audience feel the way it wanted the audience to feel? And then I also look for, of course, good acting, good storytelling, character progression is really important to me. Character arcs, some kind of character shift,
yes.
Something. Then you also have pacing and the score, the soundtrack can be great, costumes, everything. I'm just really just kind of taking it all in and trying to make note of what works and what didn't work.
I'm so glad you said character because so many people just seem to care about the plot and nitpicking the plot instead of, how are these characters being portrayed. But have you seen any changes with regard to film criticism since you first started doing it?
Well, I've definitely seen an increase in more Black and POC people being in that press and critic row. I've seen more people talking about their experiences with a film or a TV show online, particularly on Twitter. Or I met Sharonda from PayerWake.com and she does her reviews on YouTube, right? So this access to the internet where people can create a platform for themselves and just get their opinions and their voice out there to connect with other people, I think has really changed a lot.
Yeah, I think it makes it so much richer. Like for me, when I can go online and see Black women like you and like Rebecca Theodore Vachon and Candace Frederick and people like that, talking about movies that I care about and really, really seeing them and not letting stuff just go over their heads or really, really interrogating things, even if they don't fully love the movie or something like that. But just having really good discussions. What would you change about the state of film criticism and how audiences engage with film and criticism?
Well, as far as state of criticism and critics themselves, I'm always looking for more diversity in the critiques and reading. Diversity from people like we don't usually hear from, maybe people who are disabled, maybe trans folks. I don't unfortunately get to read a lot of those reviews, and I would love to because there are always things that you are missing. It could be something really great that you're missing, could be something really bad that you're missing. But I would like to hear those voices to fill in those gaps and also get for better representation.
And how How do you think audiences engage with film nowadays?
Well, again, with the internet, I think it's a lot easier for audiences to hear about films they wouldn't have heard about before, and to advocate for those films and to talk about those films, you know, directly to the actors and the studios or whomever, in a way that was completely impossible before. So I think that's definitely shifted a lot of things, and hopefully has encouraged people with power to think about things a little bit differently.
I mean, that can be very good. It can sometimes be not good. People don't know how to act. People confuse the actor with the character.
Or when people just get mad because you're ruining my childhood when you meet the Ghostbusters woman.
Okay. Or you made this character black and they're not black.
Right. Right.
It's also fiction. So.
Yeah, but I think it also really illustrates the way the things that we see, we want them to reflect our lives and the people around us. And then it also illustrates how the things that we've been seeing have not done so and have made certain people feel comfortable and entitled to seeing things always this way. You get to learn what people really care about when you hear them critique.
Shake the table, Maria. Shake the table. So, so specifically, how do you think Black women film critics are making their voices heard?
Well, also, again, through the internet, through podcasts, right? Through networking with other Black women and people of color and leaning on each other and, you know, helping each other out with connections and how to do this, how to meet this person, where to go, how to apply for that thing, you know, asking for fundraising help or all that kind of thing. Because we often have to get our own selves off the ground, but you can't ever do it alone. So... just reaching out and connecting again with the internet has been made so much easier than it would have before. You don't have the same kind of traditional gatekeepers you would through social media, although the internet does have its own challenges.
Abuse. People like to go after Black women on the internet.
Especially if you have an opinion.
There was this great line on the Good Place the other night where Maya Rudolph was guest starring, and she went down to Earth, and she said, "They really don't like Black ladies down there." Oh, sorry.
Oh my gosh, really? I haven't seen it yet. I gotta watch that one.
I was like, holy
That's
shit.
Okay. I love that.
They actually put that line in on network TV. I suspect that Maya ad-libbed it, but it was great. I felt seen. So, what do you think Black women add to the film discussion?
I think we add everything about our existence, you know. When we're not often not in control of the images that we see of ourselves, but we can always have an opinion about it. So providing that opinion lets people know, hey, this is not really that real to a general Black woman experience, or this felt very authentic and real to me.
Yes.
And I can remember like seeing Belle, the movie Belle with Gugu Mbatha-Raw. And I didn't know really too much anything about it, except that it was based on this painting and based on a real person. And there was a scene in the movie where she's trying to do her hair and she's having trouble because she's never known how to do her hair because she lives with nobody Black, you know, everyone is white. Mm-hmm. And one of the maids or servants from the household that where she's staying sees her having this trouble and goes to help her. And that's not something you would think you would see in that movie. And I knew immediately when I saw that scene, I said, somebody Black, a Black woman wrote this. Because nobody else would think to include this. I really don't believe. So
you know,
those
I
kinds
think
of very personal experiences also, and personal touches, you can even see it, you know, in Ava DuVernay's work as well. Too,
because, like, if you watch Widows, I kind
of
feel
that
like
brings a lot, of course, to film itself. And then, of course, when we see it, we can bring what we're seeing to the film discussion. Yes. So,
yeah,
I think that's important.
Yeah. Yes.
I know I can. Yeah.
And I just love hearing Black women talk about something that's really kind of struck their heart and has been like deeply meaningful to them, yeah. something they're passionate
and the
about.
And a few times when there is a movie yes. that's like made for us, by us, and just seeing and hearing Black women get excited about that and just be all about it, that's fun too.
mm-hmm. Yes, I love that.
That's so fun. So what yes. do you make of this particular award season?
Yes.
I don't really put too much enthusiasm in award seasons. They seem to be consistently disappointing in some ways.
Yes.
They typically focus on traditionally white and really kind of inaccessible films.
Yes. Yes.
Black films and Black actors and POC films and actors are kind of tokenized a lot. So they'll be nominated, but they'll never win. Or they'll be put in strange categories like The Green Book, which... You can skip it. Yes. I mean, Mahershala Ali has a really great performance because he's Mahershala Ali. He always has a really great performance. But they put that in the musical comedy category for the Golden Globes. It has music and it has comedy, but it is not either of these things.
Yeah.
And it was against Crazy Rich Asians. And I was just like, I feel like Crazy Rich Asians should have won that category because it is actually a comedy. It just seems kind of strange. I do like that we're getting a little more shine, you know, on these movies. But again, usually it's like a lot of nominations and no winning, and I'm ready for some winning.
Yeah, white people still think of diversity as quota filling, and they're not ready to deal with the fact that okay. This means that y'all have to lose.
Right.
Sometimes y'all's shit ain't that great.
Yeah. Yeah. It's also interesting because I kind of feel like Black people and actually more people of color, we're also now getting more access to like genre films. Seeing things in genre films that we don't see in like other films, because you can look at both Thor Ragnarok and Black Panther, and both of those were excellent films in their own ways. And I'm just really, really upset that Ryan Coogler is not getting any nominations either for writing or for directing. You know, I'm really disappointed none of the actors are getting nods for acting, because they were all really excellent in that film, gave all these really great performances. And if Ruth Carter does not get a nomination for costume design for Oscars,
Ruth Carter.
Well, I know y'all on some BS then anyway. Wilson, honey, Ruth Wilson? Or Ruth Carter? Wait, what? Okay. But I mean, that's just really, I mean, because I kind of feel like, and when we do, you know, do the prestige films and all, I kind of feel like they get sabotaged, or, you know, they try to get pushed aside, you know, for, okay, well, we want this, you know, we want this person and maybe not this person, because I mean, both Barry Jenkins and Steve McQueen, I think they both did really good prestige films. And I'm glad I'm seeing this, but I'm only seeing like Regina King getting nominated for
she movies, deserves and she has been deserving,
to be honest. And I'm just Yes. Yeah. And but it's just so frustrating because, you know, like I understand, like you said, you know, I don't put too much stock in the awards and stuff because, I mean,
one of my
professors in college, you know, she put it real well. It's just Hollywood playing with itself. And but it's also like the visibility that this could bring to people who might need it, you know, in some cases, not all cases, because sometimes there is, like, you know, the Oscar curse, but some people could use, you know, that type of leverage, you know, I'm an award nominee or I'm an award winner, you know, we can work with whatever I need to work with so I can, you know, get this role or do this film or, you know, do that. So that's kind of important too when you're working in that industry.
I mean,
yeah.
Mm-hmm. In a way,
yes,
the Oscars
exactly.
are still a currency. I mean, it's a weird kind of currency
yes.
in that they create
yeah, exactly.
themselves, but it's a currency and it still spins. And I think it mm-hmm. helped.
Yes.
I think it helped Barry Jenkins. It can help minority filmmakers, I think.
Regina King said, I'm putting 50% of women on all my film crews now. You know, this is what she's getting to do now. And she's been in this business how long? Yes, exactly. Exactly. She has the statues to show for. So, yeah.
So just to get that award season stuff out of the way, let's talk about If Beale Street Could Talk.
Yay!
You said you just saw it for a second time.
Oh, yes, I did.
How hard did you cry this time?
I was surprised myself because I didn't think I was going to cry.
Yeah.
But I cried. I cried. But see, the thing is, like, I cry, like, when they actually go to his apartment for the first time.
Uh-huh.
And then you hear the music of Eros, like, swelling and everything. That's the... And they're just, like, kissing on the bed. That's when I cry.
Girl.
I'm just like, it's so beautiful.
Girl, I was crying in the first 10 minutes. First, that beautiful scene of them, they're in, like, the matching colors, kind of...
Yeah, it's the yellow and blue.
Yeah,
very happy,
and I love that. And then when it gets to, you know, she's trying to tell her mom, you know, she's pregnant, she's all nervous and everything. And then, you know, mom, and then Regina King, and that's when her face is, you know, she's looking directly at the camera, and she's so beautiful, and she's like, "What, baby?" And I'm like, "Oh my God!" Just little things like that just got to me.
And you could just tell that, you know, while she was busy, you know, putting mm-hmm. her groceries away and walking back and forth, asking all these mundane type of questions, she could tell that Tish had something mm-hmm. big on her mind, and she was
yes.
giving her
yep.
space and time to figure out how
Ready.
She wanted
yes.
to make it. And I was just
yes.
like, oh, this is so
yes.
good.
Like, I know there's something on your
exactly.
mind, but you're going to tell
exactly.
me when you're ready.
Yep. And Tish finally said, "Mama," and she was like,
"Yeah,
yeah,
just
baby.
That really comforting, that soothing,
right
that soothing reaction to it. Like, you can tell me anything."
Mm-hmm. Ah, so good. Okay, so I'm just gonna be biased. I love this movie. I love, love, love this movie so much.
I love it. Yeah.
So what were your reactions to this film? This is your interview. What was your reactions?
I loved it. I love it. I like watching the movie is like falling in love. You totally fall in love with these two and like
yes.
her family specifically.
Mm-hmm.
And the music and everybody's so beautiful. It's just so lovely. It's awesome. You know, it makes you think about love itself, familial love, and then romantic love. and how they're both living in a system that's trying to break you, and how this love can be a power beyond the system that can reach through the system to try and, you know, try and reach each other. And I appreciate the way it showed the way in which systems will work together to oppress people for perceived slights. And we see also how the rape survivor is a victim of the system who didn't protect her at all.
Yes.
But used her and further traumatized her.
Yes. And to further traumatize other people. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Oh my gosh.
Yes.
So you're making abused people hurt other people. Oh my gosh. This is a wicked, wicked system. Well, yeah. I mean, that's a lot to think about in one movie. You're thinking about all these different forms of love. You're also thinking about systemic racism and social injustice in one movie. And I just, it just makes me sad that this film is kind of falling off the radar as far as award season. But, you know.
Yes.
It should be all over.
All over. I'm talking best
supporting
picture,
actor.
Best director.
Yes.
Of course, best supporting actress. Yep. Also, best supporting actor.
Best score and soundtrack.
Thank you. Thank you. That score is beautiful. Shout out to Nicholas Britell.
I'm even going to go with the costume design, too, because Tisha's wardrobe was so pretty. Yeah.
It really
Tisha's
is.
Hair.
Yes.
Shout out to whoever did her hair.
Yes.
It was fluffy cloud
that
of
beautiful.
Black beauty, and I loved it.
It's a halo. It's it's totally a halo. And there are a couple times where they shoot the light from behind. It looks totally angelic.
Like, that was intentional. That was so intentional.
Mm-hmm.
Also, her face, Kiki Wayne's face, is like innocence and beauty and just all mixed up together. And all through the movie, I could not stop thinking about how pretty she is. I'm like, oh my gosh, she's so pretty. She's so pretty. And I just, all the close-ups, I loved them. I never got tired of the close-ups because she is so pretty. Why do you think these other movies, like that you mentioned earlier, like Green Book and stuff like that, have overshadowed Beale Street?
I think it's a case of the people who are really like in charge of putting out the films and then also voting on the films. I think they can't deny how beautiful it is. Because it's undeniable. But I feel like they can't connect with the not so beautiful parts of the film. So they're probably thinking like, well, is this a love story? What kind of story is this? Like, or is this a story about civil rights? And it's really just a story about being Black and in love in America. Like, that's it. But we don't really get too many realistic portrayals of that. It's usually kind of more of just the pain side.
That's the thing about it. This is very, it's subtle and nuanced. It's very nuanced. Everybody is very layered and very three-dimensional. Well, most of the main characters, I would say the sisters, Fonny's sisters and Fonny's mother, they might be a little more 2D, but
go ahead. No, same. Well, actually, we can get to this later. But go ahead.
I just thought that Barry Jenkins just emphasized how nuanced we are as people, and how in spite of injustice and oppression and things like that, we still find space to care for people and love people and just share with other people. And there's so much warmth in the family scenes, in the scene with Daniel and Fonny and Tish, in spite of all of the dark things that get revealed in that scene, there's just so much love in this movie. But I've heard some critics say that, you know, the book is angrier, you know, this movie should be angrier, this isn't angry enough, all this stuff like that. I mean, as beautiful as it is, I came away angry because this family has been torn apart. Well, three, if you count Tish's family, three families have been torn apart.
Yep.
By something Fonny didn't even do.
And couldn't have.
Yeah, this is how systemic injustice just devastates people's lives, like generations of families.
Yes. I mean, even including survivor, you know, she fled the country.
Without her children. So that family's torn apart. That's four families.
Yep.
So if that doesn't make you angry, whatever. I don't even want to see some movies I'm kind of precious with, and I need a minute before I'm really able to handle any full critiques, good and bad. And I kind of feel this way. I feel very protective of this movie.
Yeah, I can understand that. The one thing I did read a critique that made a lot of sense to me, they were saying, we don't really know too much about Tish, like what she wants to do or the things that she likes. Like, we know Fonny is an artist, right? He has these skills. He wants to be a sculptor and everything. But we don't really know what Tish wants to do. And when she makes, for instance, like when she makes the dinner, like, does she like cooking? Is this something she learned from her mom or her dad? Or, you know, I do wish that we had a little bit more from Tish, but that would only serve to improve the movie.
But that is a good point.
I kind of wonder though, especially with Tish, and especially the way how I kind of feel like it was kind of true to, you know, to gender roles back in that time, at least. I kind of want, because see, she's very focused on Fonny. Like, we're kind of seeing, it's a question I kind of, you know, had later. I think we're kind of seeing him, we're always seeing him through her eyes.
Yeah.
And she's looking at him through this love gaze. And I'm kind of wondering, you know, is that, you know, part of it? Because it's like, she doesn't, I don't really know if she sees herself without him. And also, given that for a lot of Black women, being able to be in the home, taking care of the kids and, you know, being a housewife, there was kind of a privilege in that, especially at that time. And I'm kind of wondering, was that part of, you know, why Tish is constructed the way
she is?
She's
also 19, which is very young. Still.
Exactly.
Still.
Exactly.
Fonny was only 22.
Yeah.
And he had these ambitions about being an artist and working with wood. So, I mean, Tish could have had something. I'm sure she aspires to be more than a cashier at the perfume counter. That's still a very good point. I can deal with that. I can deal with that. just not anything else. So,
yeah.
I'm gonna be real with you. So, what do you see this film doing with Black romance that hasn't been seen previously, or where that we don't see it?
Primarily having two dark skin characters being the lead romantic role.
Think about that.
You know,
yes.
Yeah. The first screen that I went to see this movie, They had a Q&A afterwards with the director and with Regina and with Kiki Lane and with the actor that played his father as well.
Yes, he is.
He's gorgeous. And he speaks so well. I love to hear him talk. He's so interesting, and he's just given a word every time he opened his mouth.
Listen to him read the phone book. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And she talked about being in this movie and how she had wanted to be this character because she never really got to see women in romantic leads that looked like her, that had her dark skin, that had her curly hair. And so she really just kind of put herself up for the role. So that kind of ambition really just got her there.
I'm so glad. I'm so glad. I was joking with Enda that, like, Barry Jenkins doesn't know how to cast light-skinned people. He's, like, allergic.
Oh, really?
I'm just joking. Fine. He might.
No, they might be like,
because Fonny's family is supposed to be light skinned in the book. Right. That's why.
Yeah. Right, but they're not.
Tiana Paris calls Fonny's sister a yellow C word. It doesn't work because they're like the same shade. Yeah. And,
Like,
this is because Barry Jenkins is allergic.
I was like, maybe it's an ideology kind of thing.
She's like, we need more dark skinned people in this. I don't care.
Yeah.
I don't care.
Because I was looking at her like, wait, did you just call her yellow?
Yes. I'm like, y'all the same shade, sis. Y'all the same.
Yeah. Yeah.
But, yes. So, yes, we haven't seen a lot of that previously, or we don't see enough of that.
No. I'm a member of the Statue Coalition. I'm over it. Like, okay, fine. I'm good. Like,
okay.
Remember, please. Bring in more dark skinned people. Bring in more chocolate people. Bring in more dark skinned people.
Yeah. I kind of wanted to talk about the ways that the families are constructed throughout the film. Especially because I think we all said we loved Tish's family because they were just supportive of, you know, her and Fonny. But Fonny's biological family, with the exception of their dad, really seemed to be working toward being this, you know, picture of, you know, pious, you know, black respectability. And so I kind of feel like, in a way, Jenkins, I don't feel like he tries to altogether, you know, dismiss it or knock it, but he does show this, you know, family who's comfortably working class, you know, in a better light. You know, you see them having a celebration when they find out Tish is going to have a baby and, you know, won't let her feel shame about it, whereas opposed to this other family, Fonny's family, like, oh, God, ew, you're not good enough, you know, to be in this family. So not really certain what the question is. You know, I want to ask about that, but can we talk about just kind of the ways that we see, because I think something we were getting at, Didi was getting at it earlier, saying that the Fonny's family were rather two-dimensional in that regard. So, like, what he was doing with these families and painting in this way.
Well, I remember when Tish is going to talk to her family about, you know, that she's pregnant, being so nervous, being so scared for her. I didn't predict that her family would react that way at all. I've never seen that before. Where their whole family was really just about love, period. It wasn't about anything else. So while it may have been shocking and unexpected, and they were concerned for her, they didn't shame her, they didn't scare her, they supported her and showed her love.
Yes.
And And who wouldn't want to be a part of a family like that, especially if you have a family like Fonny's? Okay, where the parents are constantly bickering with each other. Mom is not willing to face up to anything, and the Lord's going to handle everything, you know, because I'm a holy roller, and that's all that matters. And I'm going to wear my, you know, skirt sets and straighten my hair, and you can't tell me anything because I'm obviously better than you, you know, kind of attitude. Right, your own grandson. How? Like, how can you be so evil?
Like, you have this close connection to the Lord, and you curse.
And then claim God.
Yeah.
Right. Okay. So, I can't really blame Fonny for wanting to be a part of that family.
Yeah, you can tell he's probably been in that apartment, run down as it is, for a minute. Like, he couldn't wait. Mm-hmm.
That's why he left and was sleeping on park benches. But you just have to wonder, like, what is going on with the mom? Because it seems like there's some serious self-loathing going on there.
And she passed it down to all the kids, too.
Mm-hmm. Well, it seems like, you know, be the way that she wants you to be or be out of her sight, right? Because her daughter is fawning all over her. Even though Tisha's sister is like, well, I know about you and I know about you.
Tisha's sister, I kind of felt like she was a bit queer. I really wanted to see more of that.
I did. I liked her. I liked them together. I would love to see more of that.
Yeah. Because she was just kind of, you know, on one hand, she's also really, you know, supportive, but she's also the teasing, you know, and all that. Oh, what she called it, what Jezebel, when she's working at the perfume counter. But this is also the same sister, you know, unbow your head sister, you know, like when she finds out, I know, like, girl, you have nothing to be ashamed of. And just to be that type that you can, you know, be light and, you know, just, and also having her back like that, because she's the one who jumped in her girl's face, like, you're not going to talk to my sister this way. You know, I mean, I loved her.
I'll rip your Adam's apple out with my teeth.
I can't decide if I want to rip it out with my teeth or my finger. But if you touch my little sister, I'm going to make a choice.
Yes.
Please touch her.
She was about that life.
She was. What did you make of what Michael Beach did to Anjanue Ellis?
Oh.
That scene, because I was like, I wonder why, about of all things, because Jenkins did take some things that happened at the end of the book and he didn't include them in the movie. But I'm thinking that incident happened in the book, and I'm wondering why he chose to keep it in the movie. Oh, sorry.
You'll have to tell me what you're referring to. I never read it.
When Michael Beach, Fonny's dad, hits Anjanue Ellis, Fonny's mom. I wonder why. I wonder why that was in the movie. Just to show how much Fonny's dad don't really fuck with Fonny's mom no more, or just to show.
How messed up that family is. I mean, because, you know, she is cursing his grandson, but also you don't need to call off and hit her like that.
In front of a whole other family of people. Like, you know, it's 1974. That shit wasn't okay then. It's not okay now. I don't know. Yeah, I guess. That definitely says this family is fucked up.
I think we kind of got it. The next two. I think we kind of got it that. So, maybe just I wanted to ask, how important is it that we see Black men constructing images of Black love and romance?
I think it's very important because we really don't see that often at all, particularly Black men and Black women being romantic together. So it's interesting to me to see that from a Black man's perspective. Don't really get to see that. Don't really get to see too much from a Black woman's perspective either. But I also think it could be a possible powerful tool for purging a little toxic masculinity out of there.
Yeah. That's because I think Barry Jenkins is cishet. I think he is. And he does really well with, you know, because I mean, especially, of course, like with Moonlight, like, okay, we may be going through some bullshit, but, you know, we can still find ways to have that type of love and that type of intimacy when we need it. You know, just have to be, you know.
Well, one thing that seems clear to me is that he listens to people and he values other people's words. Because one thing he was saying particularly about Beale Street is he was thinking about the way he was going to shoot the scene where Fonny and Tish first make love. And he was telling a friend of his about it, this woman, like how he was going to shoot it, how he wanted it to look, how he wanted it to be like kind of the focus on her face. While Fonny is all kind of like fuzzy in the background, and you just kind of hear the rain and everything. And she was like, no, show Fonny taking off his clothes.
Thank you!
Like, Tish wants to see this too. And he was like, oh, okay, yeah.
Oh my God, yes.
Yeah. Like, they were saying if it was the other way around, you would be objectifying that woman. So objectify him.
And got that really, really nice shot when he takes his pants off.
Hello, Stephen James.
Yes. And I just...
Hello, little
Stephen. Listen.
You can just see, like, her eyes are just full of him.
Yeah, that's just... That is exactly one of the things that I loved about it. Because, like I was saying, you see Fonny through her eyes. And so this is kind of like, you're kind of in place a lot of times. And so... I just loved how that whole thing went down because, you know, he undresses her, which is a weakness of mine. I have to say, that is a weakness.
He has these beautiful, soft eyes.
Yes. Just the way they kept, like, he did not relent. Like, he didn't, like, just keep showing them, you know, looking at each other or that gaze that he's known for now. He didn't just show that a couple of times, like, in the beginning and quit, like, you get that all through, you know, the entire film. And I just kind of love that even in the end, when, you know, see, they've, like she's saying, they're not young anymore. They've had to grow up through all of this. But even in the end, after, you know, they're sitting there, you know, with their with their baby, with their son. And you just kind of know that even though they've been through all of this horrible stuff, they're still in love because you see that they're still holding hands and they're looking into each other's eyes. And so they just did not give up on that love that they had between them, even though at this point they're not in the most ideal of circumstances.
Love is what brought you here. Trust it all the way. Oh. So, who do you want to see in a Barry Jenkins film with his gorgeous cinematography and fully humanized portrayals?
I would love to see some disabled people or some fat people with those kind of portrayals.
Girl.
There was, this comedian had a show on Netflix. Aziz Ansari? There's one particular episode where it follows this deaf or hard of hearing couple.
Yeah. I remember this
thing. And then, you know, they're having, like, you know, this fight, you know, whatever, and he won't go down on her and all this kind of stuff. And they're signing this whole thing out in public, and it's really great.
Yeah, episode. I really saw funny. Like, I was gift like, set of that.
But
that
I want to see funny. More of that.
That was so funny.
Yeah, where is their
yeah.
TV show? Yeah.
Imagine what he could do.
I would watch a show about them.
Work. Oh. Yeah.
Any of it. Or Beverly
Yeah, because I just realized both Moonlight and Bill Street, those are both written by black men. Ah, yeah, sure. Yeah, exactly.
Mm.
He adapted
yeah.
work from black
women. He is actually somebody I would trust to adapt from a black woman. Because like you said, he listens to people. And I feel like he would listen to like, okay, this is, you know, mm-hmm. this, you know, would or wouldn't work, you know, in this way, because this is what's going to happen if you do it this way. And so, yeah, I kind of feel like he really would listen.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Wow.
So thank you so much, Maria. We could talk about this for hours, but everybody's got things Truly. To do. But thank you so much for joining us.
Yay.
Oh, thank you. Yes. We'll have to have you on. We'll have to do something sometime so we can just talk about widows.
Yes. Yes. I could talk.
Yeah.
Yes.
Oh, please. Yes. Yeah. I can't
All
wait.
All three of us just get together. Maybe.
I could write.
I don't know if you want to do something for the Patreon. We could just get together and talk about widows because I'm so. I love that movie so
yes.
much. And
I could write sonnets. I could write sonnets about that film.
Mm-hmm.
So good.
I mean, it's like a book.
Yes.
It's like they wrote a book and just filmed it. So, but until next time, please check out Black Girl Squee on Twitter. Oh, wait. We need to plug Maria's stuff
yes,
again.
Yes.
You can see she's all over these podcast streets, as we said before. She's on Nerdgasm Noir Network. She's on the B-Roll podcast. You can hear her on Missives from the Underground on Black Girl Squee Network, on blackgirlsquee.simplecast.fm. What's the website for the B-Roll podcast? Is it just the B-Roll podcast?
Yes, the B-Roll podcast, everywhere you listen to podcasts.
And, of course, you should already be listening to Nerdgasm Noir. And she's also on Twitter at Valor More Dollars.
Yes, all men must pay.
That's right. you want to shout out that Cash App?
Okay. That is Maria CJ. Yes,
that's right. So we're seeing all the movies and do all the things. So at Maria CJ on Cash App and send her some folding money. Not no change. Strictly fold money. And look for her reviews on ShakeFire. So, Black Girl Squee is available on Twitter, Tumblr, Apple Podcasts, and Google Play, and any other podcatcher. If you like Pocket Cast, Podcast Addict, Overcast, I don't know, there's a whole bunch of podcast apps, but just search Black Girl Squee, we should come up. If you want to send some money our way to help us get new equipment and things like that, you can donate to patreon.com/blackgirlsquee and check out our bonus content. You can check out Inda and her mini podcasts. She's out here in these podcasts as well. You can find her radio show on Mixcloud. That's mixcloud.com/IndaLauren. I'm plugging it because she won't. She's available at Inda's Corner on Twitter. I'm at Dust Daughter. We're both at Black Girl Squee. And you can find all our episodes, including Missives from the Underground, Get Her in the Game, A Pitch Podcast, and, of course, Black Girl Squee, and Ratchet Research on blackgirlsquee.simplecast.fm. I forgot my own damn shows. So, until next time, when I hopefully get it to
Bye. You.